Hello and welcome to the as yet unnamed London Theatre Podcast for the 22nd of July 2018. My name's TRB Watson and this time I'm joined by Johnny Fox, Gareth James and Paul in London. We're now going to talk about The King and I at the London Palladium. This is the 1950s musical by Richard Rodgers and Oscar Hammerstein, based on a novel called Anna and the King of Siam, which in turn was based on the true life of a woman called Anna Leon Owens, who became the governess to the court of Siam, later Thailand, and her interactions with the King of Siam. In the musical, it's not exactly certain, but it's believed to be a version of a king called Mongkut. This production has in part been brought over from the 2015 Broadway production, which was directed by Bartlett Sher and starred Kelly O'Hara and Ken Watanabe as Anna and the King. Gareth, tell me more about this production, what you thought of it.
Well, it is the Broadway production, really. There's the same sets, the same designs, the same leads. There are a couple of other cast changes, but to all intents and purposes, it's the much garlanded Broadway revival that's now at the Palladium. And all of this year's openings, I wasn't expected to disappoint. This wasn't the one. But I'm afraid it did for me. It starts really well. The curtain comes up and you have this incredible boat that brings Anna and her son to Bangkok, arriving, and then you hear Kelly O'Hara's voice for the first time, and it takes your breath away. So it starts really, really well. But then, as the show progresses, it becomes increasingly unengaging and uninvolving. There's no question that the designs by Michael Jürgen and the costumes by Catherine Zuber are absolutely sumptuous and gorgeous. So it looks brilliant. There's no question about that at all. And you've got some really cute kids. You've got some really good songs, although they are kind of very sweet songs and some might say very twee songs. But there's really not a lot of heart in this version. And I've seen the show twice before, once at the Palladium in a previous production, which I think was Elaine Page, and once in the round in the Royal Albert Hall, which was Maria Friedman and the Jeremy Sammons production. And to me, this just didn't work. You know, like other Rodgers and Hammerstein shows, it's tackling sort of serious themes. Siam, of course, which is now Thailand, was an independent country, whilst all the countries around it in that part of Southeast Asia were taken, you know, by colonial powers. And indeed, during the show, the French take Cambodia. There's sort of references to that during the show. So, you know, we are seeing the unacceptable face of colonialism. We're seeing the sort of very arrogant superiority of the West over other cultures. But we also, because the king is a bit of a despot, we also see the downsides of the despotic regime, and in particular, superiority over women. So you put into this kind of cocktail a sort of feisty Welsh woman. And, you know, it's a recipe, it's a classic kind of Rodgers and Hammerstein, really. You know, you've got exotic setting, glorious score. The problem for me is that two things. First is that they have mined deeper into the themes of power and culture and feminism. But at the same time, they've also broadened the humour, particularly through the king's character. I found the contrast of those two things just jarred with me, really. I thought, and I can understand why you would do the former, because in the present day and age, if you didn't do that, then it could be seen as a sort of deeply racist, objectionable show. But doing the two together just didn't work for me at all, really. The pace after this initial opening became quite slow in parts, and there's a second act play within a play, which seemed very, very long. I mean, it just seemed to go on forever. I think it was about 20 minutes. And the whole 3 hours, frankly, seemed a very long 3 hours. I think the crux of the casting is that, to me, there is a lack of chemistry between the king and Anna. And that was what finished it for me, really. I thought Kelly O'Hara was brilliant, and I thought her singing is absolutely gorgeous. But I really, really am afraid didn't take to Ken Watanabe's king. I just thought he created a caricature. And I know I'm on my own, because reading all the reviews, they're all being very flattering about what he's done, really. When you hear her sing Hello, Young Lovers, I mean, you've never heard it so beautifully. It's just gorgeous. There's some other really nice performances as well. John Chu, really nice characterization as the sort of very earnest, very geeky son who's the crown prince. And then there's a couple of lovers, our own Dean John Wilson and Na Young Jeon. They make, I think, a very good pair of lovers at Tip Tim and Lun Tha. And there is an excellent performance now from Naoko Mori, who is the chief wife, as it were, Lady Thang. And I thought she had great presence and sang very well as well, really. But for me, it was the king that let it down from a performance point of view, which I thought proved fatal from my point of view. But good to see a stage full of East Asian actors. You know, there's going to be no arguments about Yellowface here. I mean, the stage is full of great performances by a largely British cast. So I did end up disappointing. I mean, there were things to love about it. It looked great. You know, singing was great. The band played well. There were some very good performances in it. But it didn't engage me and it didn't involve me. And I didn't really feel very much. It had no heart for me. And I feel the crux of that is that Bartlett-Share has been too reverential. He's kind of afraid to touch it. I remember saying the same about Funny Girl when Funny Girl was on at the Menier and then in the West End. I felt that here's an American director who's afraid to mess things up. And as a result of that, has been a bit too conservative and a bit too reverential. And here, we're used to seeing, you know, new productions breathing new life into shows like this. The most recent one I can think of is Carousel of the Arcola, you know, another Rodgers and Hammerstein show, where I thought they really did breathe new life into that. At the National Theatre, we've had new productions of Oklahoma and South Pacific, which also breathe new life into these 50s shows. So it's not that it can't be done, but it isn't done here. And I know I'm a bit of a lone voice, although there were a couple of fairly indifferent reviews in, I think, the Metro and Time Out. But I think clearly, obviously, people have fallen for the grandeur and fallen for the voice of Kelly O'Hara, and indeed, so did I. But that wasn't enough for me. And I thought there were too many things wrong about it to make it the classic revival that everybody's been talking about, really.
So, John, what do you think about The King and I?
I'm so pleased to see this in London. I think it's a wonderful piece of work. And I think it's an interesting piece of work as well. 70 years before Maria left the Abbey to look after the Von Trapp children, British governess Anna Leanne Owens sailed to Bangkok to tutor 82 princes and princesses of the Siamese court. So straight away, she far outranks the Austrian postulant for both class, size and for influence, because the real Anna Leanne Owens genuinely did have the ear of the King of Thailand, sorry, King of Siam, as he was in those days, and was able to, if not provide emancipation, at least speak up for certain aspects of social and legislative life as far as it regarded slavery or the role of women. But, you know, this is the 1860s. This is a very long time ago. I also like The King and I because the musicals that Rodgers and Hammerstein wrote around each of these two different governesses, Maria von Trapp and Anna Leanne Owens, are also on a different scale. If you talk about the stage version of The Sound of Music, it's a very contained story. It's very domestic in scale, and it's a heartwarming tale, which was completely rewritten and improved by the Robert Wise film. But the stage show itself is dreadfully repetitive with many of the childish songs. But The King and I is epic and on a grander scale. And as I say, it directly addresses issues like slavery and sexism and racism as Anna mentors the wives and children of the Siamese court with her take on Western values. But that in its turn is overlaid with her interpretation of Western values as embodied by subjects of Queen Victoria's empire in the 1860s and overlaid again by Rodgers and Hammerstein's mores of mid-century America. You know, we're really in the Truman era and McCarthyism has just started. So it is socially and politically fascinating, as well as being, you know, a cracking good musical right up at the top of their game. But I think the balance of the show, and I think the audience's reaction to it, pivots on casting. In the original, you had Yul Brynner as a very, very forceful king, at least evenly matched with Gertrude Lawrence, especially as Gertrude Lawrence's voice began to be a bit dodgy towards the end of the run. And then again, Brynner did it at the end of his career in 1979 when I saw it here at the Palladium, opposite Virginia McKenna, where, again, he really outshone her. Now the polarity is reversed because here you have Kelly O'Hara trailing a cloud of Broadway success, and she redefines the role for me in a way that not only laid the ghost of every previous incumbent, funnily enough, she looks a bit like Virginia McKenna did, but she sings better than anybody who's ever done this before. She has a set of vocal techniques and a skill and a subtlety in her acting that outshines all our homegrown talent. There's something quite extraordinary about how she sings. And I spoke afterwards to Rhea Jones, who had been Glenn Close's cover in Sunset Boulevard. And we were trying to define what it was in Kelly O'Hara's voice that just sets her apart from practically anybody else who attempts these kinds of roles. Her voice has an intense soprano power, even in the softest lines and at the beginning of some of the verses, where anybody else might just coast gently into a piece. She has such support for the very quietest of the words, and a diction and an English inflection are so almost impeccable. But what happens is when the voice climbs through a crescendo, it does so seamlessly. There is no gear change. There is no shift from chest voice to head voice. There's no stagey belting. There's no break. It is rare and enchanting to hear, and it really defies any kind of analysis, even though I tried just to give one. She is glorious in this role, and she owns it completely. Ken Watanabe, playing the King, sadly, is not in the same class. Because they've worked together for a while, there is real tangible chemistry with O'Hara, and he has very nice comic timing, which consistently debunks the pomposity of the King. But particularly in Act One, he is unpardonably indistinct, and his diction destroys the lyrics. It's unfortunate, really, that only three of the cast came over from the Lincoln Center production, or were due to come over from the Lincoln Center production. A personal tragedy prevented Ruthie Ann Miles from re-delivering her Tony Award-winning performance as the head wife, Lady Tiang. So you've really got Watanabe, apart from Kelly O'Hara, as the only American star, and he's an Oscar winner and heaven knows what else. And it made me question whether we didn't have an Asian actor who could have stepped up and carried this part. Elsewhere, I think the casting is a bit hit and miss. Takao Osawa, another UK debut, plays the Kralahome, home. That's the sort of prime minister character. And that character is usually the understudy to the King. And I would be fascinated to go to a performance where perhaps Watanabe takes a vacation and Osawa plays the King. There's a guy called John Chu playing Prince Chulalongkorn. Incidentally, a part in which I was cast when I was 12. Chulalongkorn is a real character. He was 15 when his father died and he ascended the throne. And John Chu, I thought, looked a bit adult for that character. He looks actually a bit middle-aged. And Nai Young John is very nice and affecting Tuck Tim. That's the slave girl who is presented as a gift by the Sultan of Burma to the King of Siam. And she has a lover who is a little bit of a rebel and wants her to run away from the palace. His name is Lun Tar. And in America, he was played by an Asian actor. Now, we've had big campaigns about yellowface and not having white men or white women play Asian people. But they've cast Dean John Wilson, who is an English musical theatre leading lad, leading boy, who had recently played Aladdin, also at the Palladium. And for me, he seemed really flat and stilted, and as though he were still playing Aladdin and thought this was all a pantomime. But, you know, the children are as enchanting as the children always are in The King and I, even though there are only nine of them, and of course the infant princess just steals the show. Just going back to the pantomime thing, you know, there are constant set changes. I think you need about 17 different sets for The King and I, and a glittery front cloth, which has been brought in for the production, is repeatedly drawn backwards and forwards across the stage. And I thought Bartlett Sher's production really did have something of a pantomime feel. And you can use that as praise because it's very glittery and the costumes are fabulous and all that sort of thing. You could also use it as a criticism to say that it was a little bit unnaturalistic. And in the Thai-styled ballet, Small House of Uncle Thomas, although the choreography by Christopher Telly, which is derived from the original Jerome Robbins work, is tremendous. It really is. And the 40-odd cast are just wonderful. They really show their dancing skills. I thought that at 16 minutes in a three-hour show, it was just a tiny bit too much of a good thing. The show has been very slightly updated. Actually, it's a very nice song that has been restored called Western People Funny, which is sung by the wives of the King and is quite nice. But sensibly, it resists reference to contemporary politics. Although there was a laugh in the audience when the bombastic King boasts he wants to build a wall around Siam. But the hints at modernisation and emancipation remain. And as I say, detractors have questioned whether the replacement of traditional Thai values with those of the moralising empire builders of the mid-Victorian era would actually constitute an improvement. You can say that, you know, like Britain, Siam and later Thailand remains unconquered and uncolonised by any other nation. None of which undermines the fact that The King and I is an immense piece of work, and it's so good in cost-constrained times to see a grand production in a great theatre. And if you want that kind of special, splendid night out, I really don't think you can do better than to go and see this at the Palladium. And there's just this undefinable thing that happens in the audience, that, you know, there is tremendous, wonderful applause for lots of moments. And then there's just that little moment before the next song starts where you feel 2,250 people falling in love with Kelly O'Hara. And I haven't known that sort of instant affection for a performer since Hugh Jackman came on stage in 1982 in Oklahoma and suddenly everybody loved him. So it's really nice to witness something like that. And there is nothing I could say about her other than she is the best performer of this role I have ever seen.
We're now going to talk about But It Still Goes On by Robert Graves. This is Robert Graves' 1932 play, which has been edited and given additional dialogue by the playwright Fidelis Morgan. It has been done at the Finborough Theatre. It is directed here by Fidelis Morgan with a set design by Doug Mackey. It stars Alan Cox, Victor Gardner, Jack Claff, Hayden B. Morse, Rachel Pickup, Claire Redcliffe, Joshua Ward, Sophie Ward, and Charlotte Weston. It concerns a young man called Dick Tompion, who is a minor novelist and poet. He is bullied by his much better known father, Cecil Tompion, who is a rather more major mainstream novelist. His best friend, David, may well be gay, and he's taking his time getting engaged to his longtime girlfriend, Charlotte. There is a certain amount of distance between them. Paul, tell me more about this play and what you thought of it.
Yeah, thanks, Tim. I think, you know, one of the things that's quite interesting about this piece is that, you know, notwithstanding that additional dialogue has been, you know, added by the director, it feels a very modern piece of storytelling. And it actually isn't, because it's actually specifically about a crisis within a family that's sort of being displayed as almost like a drawing room comedy, because I think that's the format it tries to evoke. But it's this crisis in the family during the interwar period. And as you mentioned, you know, there's the father that looms large over the family, but the son who was in the First World War in the trenches, and he feels like he killed the man because he wouldn't fight. And he's sort of haunted by this young man throughout the piece. But I think what's fascinating about this piece is, you know, it's quite a compact story that moves quite quickly. You know, it's part comedy, it's part tragedy, melodrama. But so much comes together as this family has these secrets and discussed at length in quite frank ways, that actually, you know, does give this piece a little bit more edge. It's quite interesting that it's not been universally liked by a lot of people, but actually I found sitting through it, I thought it was quite intriguing, both in its, you know, depictions of a very frank sex life and relationships, because actually one of the characters has a relationship, wants to get married because, you know, that's what people do, even though affections are for the same sex. And another one wants to, you know, get married to have a child, and the other person that they wanted to get married to doesn't want to get married because, you know, having experienced the war, I can't imagine why anybody would want to bring children into it anymore. And so a lot of the things they're talking about feel also like they're very contemporary topics to today and have some relevance, that, you know, why would you want to bring a child into the world when the world is in political and environmental collapse, and all the same sort of things that people talk about. I think also it's probably worth mentioning that Robert Graves, this was an unproduced play during his lifetime, and it probably was a little bit too frank in its depictions of sex and so forth. I think what's really stronger in it is actually the impact of the First World War and how it just haunts these characters. And in this particular production, it's literally haunts them, because the main character, who's the son, Dick, played really well by Alan Cox is followed around by this dead soldier on stage, which is somewhat unnerving. But I think Finborough is putting this out as part of its Great War at 100 Years series. But I think what the writer, Robert Groves, has really pointed out is, you know, that war was hell and there was nothing particularly great about it. And the impact of it continued to be felt throughout the times. The cast, I think, were terrific in this. In addition to Alan Cox, I thought the daughter, played by Rachel Pickup, and the best friend, Richard Gardner, they were all incredibly good choice of casting, I think, for these roles, in addition to the friend, Sophie Ward. It works really well as a piece. It's a very simple-looking production, and it's meant to look a bit like, I think, a tent during the war, even though it's meant to be a drawing room or a house in London. But I think that's, notwithstanding that, I think the performances, the dialogue really come out in this piece. And I thought it was a really well-crafted production that, you know, while it wasn't ready for the stage maybe in the 1920s, 1930s, it certainly is well worth having a look at now.
I like this a lot. I did think, though, that it's kind of thing where, of course, you couldn't have done it back in the 1920s because the Lord Chancellor would put a line through all of it, pretty much, because of tolerance of homosexuality. There are both gay men and lesbians in this play. One character doesn't quite get on when he finds out that his intended is a lesbian, but that's possibly because he feels that he should be sincerely loved, and it wouldn't be sincere. It would just be an arrangement, which he finds offensive. So there's slightly different treatment of gay men and lesbians in it, but it really would have benefited from a few months touring and out of town. I mean, the way they used to do it quite a lot is they would tour around the country to get the play right, and then they would bring it into London once they'd worked out the bells and whistles. And this is a play that did need editing, it needed sharpening up, and I think Fidelis Morgan has done a bit of it. It also needs it to be Robert Graves. Now, Robert Graves is a man I deeply admire in his writing. He is, of course, the author of I, Claudius and Claudius the God, but also his war memoir, Goodbye to All That, is one of the most stunning First World War memoirs there is. It is a really fascinating look back on his life in the trenches. There is an autobiographical part of this play, which is that he was at first overshadowed by his father, who was a great Welsh poet. And in his early writings and in his early poetry, he was overshadowed by this much more forceful figure in his life, his father. So I did wonder if that's what we were getting from this play. We're getting a slightly autobiographical play. I mean, certainly there were one or two people in his life, I'm thinking Siegfried Sassoon, but there were one or two people in his life who were homosexual. And there were stories also about Robert Graves. He had a fairly complex love life, shall we say. But he is a rather fascinating character, and I think this captures it. But as I say, I thought it needed work, and it's such a pity that we weren't accepting back in the 1930s. Actually, I think it's 1929 this was commissioned and written, although it's set in 1932. We weren't as accepting things that are brought up in there back in the 1920s and 30s, and it is a great pity because this has a potential to be a really great play, but it just simply wouldn't have been put on, and it needed to have been put on. It needed to have been put on back then rather than so much here. But I think this is a very well done production and a really interesting take. It's just not quite up there with the great plays of the period, and it's not its fault. I mean, it's because they simply couldn't perform it at the time. You know, there's some great playing. It's always fun to see Jack Claff and Sophie Ward. I mean, in fact, this would not be a bad cast in the West End, and this is in a small upstairs room at the Finborough. So it's always remarkable how Finborough gets these people to do this, but I think they really care about this play and have really wanted to go with it, because I think it was very well worth putting on and rediscovering.
I think, just to add on the Finborough always does good stuff, so I think that's why they get such a great cast. But yeah, I agree. It would have been fascinating to have seen this piece if it had got a West End run at that time, because it would have been interesting to see what they would have toned down in the subject matter.
We're now going to talk about It Happened in Key West at the Charing Cross Theatre. This is a new musical based on a true story of a man who was rather too fascinated, a doctor indeed, I believe, who was rather too fascinated in one of his patients. And unfortunately, she was dead. Paul, tell me more about this musical and what you thought of it.
Yes, it's really a musical for necrophiliacs, Tim. But actually, you know, the interesting thing about this show is that, yes, it was based on a true story that happened in the 1940s about this quack doctor, because he wasn't actually a doctor, but he posed himself as a doctor and was a radiologist in Key West. And at that time, Key West seems to have been not quite, you know, the tourist destination that it is today. And I suspect it's also because it didn't have the infrastructure that it probably has today in terms of getting to it. So it was a little bit remote as well. And for those sort of familiar with that area, there's a series of bridges that now connect to it. And it's, you know, quite nice at the right time of the year, although don't be there around hurricane season because it'd be quite rough. So anyway, this happened in the 40s that he was treating a Cuban-American woman, I believe, at the time for tuberculosis, who just so happened to be the exact image of the woman his grandmother described in a vision. It would be the woman that he would live with for the rest of his life. So naturally, he took an interest in treating for her, and he was paying for her treatments. Unfortunately, because she had such advanced tuberculosis, she died. So he decided to pay for the burial. Well, actually, she was put in a tomb, an above-ground tomb. So he paid for that. And then 2 years after her death, he decided to steal her body because he heard that she had asked for him to do that, and decided to, you know, live with her for the following 7 years. So that's basically what the musical is about. It's a very bizarre story. But the irony then becomes is that once he gets found out that he's been parading this woman around, it's almost a bit like the scenes like it could be Weekend at Bernie's, if anyone's familiar with that late 80s movie where he's parading her about, you can imagine. But once he's found out, he becomes a bit of a sensation because he's seen as not a necrophiliac, but just a man besotted and in love, which probably didn't actually correspond to what was really going on, because during her life, there was no evidence that she was interested in him, and it was really a one-way relationship. None of that's really explored, which is probably a bit of a shame about his, because actually Carl, who's this quack doctor, is played very sympathetically by Wade McCollum, who, if anyone has seen the online web series Submissions Only, plays the creepy boyfriend of the casting director in the later seasons of it. And he's quite a clever American song and dance man. He's done a lot of Broadway and so forth. But actually, sitting there watching it, though, you actually are somewhat perplexed, because actually, and particularly in the first half, you're not quite sure if it's meant to be a comedy or a melodrama. And actually, I think probably it's, if the musical has further iterations to go, it would be probably a good idea to actually clarify that that was actually its intention. But as you particularly, things really pick up well in the second part, it's quite clear that we're firmly in comedic territory. This show has book, music and lyrics by Jill Santoriello, book and additional lyrics by Jason Hooser, and the original concept and book was by Jeremiah James. I believe it was presented in a theatre in Pennsylvania that Wade McCollum is connected with as well. But it's having its first European premiere and its London premiere here at the Charing Cross Theatre. I think it's quite an interesting piece of musical theatre as well, because actually it comes across as a very polished production, and something that people who are familiar with new musicals in London might be a little bit surprised about, because actually, while it's quite simple staging with a very simple backdrop of projections, they're actually done quite cleverly, and they aid and abet the story quite well. And actually, I was quite impressed sitting there watching this cast pull off what should be a very unremarkable story and an unlikely feat. And I think part of that is the combination of Wade McCollum in the lead role, but also Elisa Martin as the tragic love of his life, Elena. They don't go into too many of the gory details about how he managed to make a lifeless corpse full of life 2 years after she dies, but there's enough in it to be slightly creepy. But in fact, perhaps, you know, what would give this show a little bit more edge is to actually not hold back and just go all the way. But you know, ultimately, I really liked it. And I think it's only got a short run. It's something different that is probably worth having a check out if you're into new musical theatre and also new musical theatre on Tim Burton-esque type scale.
We're now going to talk about King Lear at the Duke of York's Theatre. This is a transfer in from the Chichester Festival Theatre and stars Ian McKellen. This is Ian McKellen's second go at the role. He played it for the RSC in 2007, which was transferred into the New London Theatre. And he's also appeared before in King Lear, well, probably more than one time, but the last big King Lear he did before that was back in the early 90s, where he played Kent to Brian Cox's King Lear in a sort of double bill. In the other part of the double bill, he played Richard III and Brian Cox played Buckingham. And interestingly enough, this is the Richard III in modern dress that gave rise to the film that Ian McKellen later made of that play. So he has a bit of a history of this, and I have to say I was rather surprised to see him taking on this play again, because he's kind of done it. He did it at the RSC. I was not entirely happy with that production. I thought it was a bit overlaid, a bit Chekhovian. It was set in sort of Tsarist Russia, by the looks of things. Lots of those long Russian coats and big fur hats. This production, I believe, is more modern dress. He is accompanied on his journey with Sinead Cusack playing Kent, Danny Webb playing Gloucester, Kirsty Bushell playing Regan, James Corrigan playing Edmund, Lloyd Hutchinson playing the Fool, Claire Price playing Goneril, Luke Thompson playing Edgar, Anita Joy Oweja playing Cordelia, and we also have Anthony Howell playing Albany and Daniel Rabin playing Cornwall. Gareth, tell me more about this production, what you thought of it.
Well, I'm a regular in Chichester every summer, and my one regret is not booking to go and see this there last year when it was at the Minerva Theatre. And my thinking at the time was I'd already seen his King Lear. I'd already seen Ian McKellen King Lear in 2007, so why would I want to go and see it again, really? But having now succumbed in the West End, I now realise that was rather flawed thinking. What they've done here is they've brought it up from the Minerva, but with a significant number of cast changes. So there are seven new members of the cast in quite big roles, including Edgar and Edmund. And they've changed the Duke of York's Theatre, which is a relatively small theatre anyway, as is the Minerva. But they've actually put a platform from the stage to the back of the stalls, which actually takes out quite a few rows at the back and quite a few seats from every row in the middle. But it does bring an intimacy to the stalls, although I don't know how it plays out in upper tiers. I suspect it's not an issue in upper tiers because they're not acting on the platform. They're just using the platform to come and go. But it certainly did something for the space sitting in the stalls. I mean, I've seen a lot of King Lear's. I counted up, and I think it's my 14th. And in fact, I've seen five since I last saw Ian McKellen in King Lear. So obviously, I've had a sort of an interest in seeing it more in recent years. But it is a very different reading by McKellen than last time round. I mean, it is a sort of contemporary Britain. He starts off in military uniform, not unlike the uniform he was wearing in Richard III in that National Theatre production. And the clothing and the setting, it just sort of seems contemporary. So it's kind of timeless contemporary rather than, you know, any specific gimmickly contemporary, as it were. And my response to this Lear was different to others, really. I always thought that falling for the sycophancy of two older daughters, but, you know, rather than the sincerity of your third daughter, is always a bit implausible. But what happens here is Goneril and Regan actually come over not just contemptuous of him, but they come over as contemptuous of the old. So there's a sort of ageism in their particular reading of it. And Regan in particular is very self-obsessed and very self-centered, and much more so than I've ever seen in the character before. Casting Sinead Cusack as Kent, they're not just casting a woman in a man's role. They've changed the role when they refer to her as the Countess of Kent. And having that actually subtly changes and kind of softens the character. I mean, it's not an unsympathetic character anyway, but it seems much softer, much more empathetic. And here the character of Edmund seemed to me to be much more Machiavellian than I've seen that played before. And in contrast, Edgar more empathetic than I've seen before. Lear's madness comes over initially as just eccentricity, but it does, you know, follow a tragic path, as it were. So it does change as it goes through. And I thought that was a very interesting transition, a very well acted and well thought out transition. So I thought the Lear was, you know, it was a very intelligent take on the play. It seemed very fresh to me. And I was very glad I went back to see it, not least for seeing Ian McKellen do it again, as it were. From the original cast, Sinead Cusack was the Kent in the original cast, and Danny Webb was the Gloucester in the original cast, and they're both really good. But the one that blew my mind from the people who've come with it is Kirsty Bushell, who I just thought was quite possibly the best Reagan I've ever seen. She was absolutely brilliant. And there's quite a small role for Oswald, and somehow Michael Matus just makes more of this role. I don't know, it just seems so much more significant to me than I've kind of thought of that character before, really. But we've got some very good new cast members. Amongst those, I would pick out Luke Thompson, who is a superb Edgar, and indeed the contrast, James Corrigan, who is very, very good indeed as Edmund. And the Fool is new, this time Lloyd Hutchison, and I think he makes a great job of it. And again, a very different reading, a less lost reading, I suppose, so I can't think of a better way to put it, really. So I thought the production was very good. I thought all of the acting was very good. It is a very good cast. And I just think it was great to see Ian McKellen do it again. And it is his 80th year. I mean, he's 79, so he's entered his 80th year. And of course, that's as close as I've ever seen it to the age of the character, because he refers to himself 80. I can't remember the exact words. So he's clearly in his 80s. And it's also the oldest Lear I've ever seen, of all the Lears I've seen. And in comparison with the 2007 reading, I thought it was gentler and sadder. I was very glad to see him do it again, really. So the final point I'd make about it is that, I mean, West End programmes are notorious for being absolute rubbish. This one is really excellent, because there are four very, very interesting essays in it. And one of them is by the historian David Starkey. He's kind of suggesting that when this was put on and played before King James, that Shakespeare was, in fact, you know, had a good relationship with James, and he was having a dialogue with his patron, possibly even sending him messages about the consequences of dividing a kingdom. And I thought that was very interesting, you know, thinking about that. And I thought, well, it was clearly sending messages then, but it's also sending messages now. So I still feel the play is a very timely play. Whichever way, you know, whichever time you see it, you see different things in it, but you always see something in it. So I was very glad to go back and see it. And well, I'd recommend it to anyone, but the trouble with the transfer is it's significantly more expensive than it was in Chichester, and very, very hard to get tickets. But if you can, go.
You can find us at AYULTP on Twitter, on the Azeta named London Theatre Podcast page on Facebook, on the web we are AYULTP.com. The podcast can also be found on both iTunes and Stitcher, where you can leave a review. Thank you. Goodbye.